Kia ora koutou. Tena koutou, tena koutou, tena koutou katoa. Welcome everybody to the European Institute webinar, Indoor Bubbles and Garden Gatherings, Envisaging Care, Social Contact, New Zealand Style Solutions in UK's Corona Crisis Response. My name is Alan Franz. I'm a Professor of Sociology in the Faculty of Social Science at Auckland University. I have tasked today of chairing this fascinating event, and I will oversee the kind of process and the questioning at the end as well. Just want to welcome you to my bubble. This is where I spent 6 weeks in New Zealand, in Snells Beach in the north of Auckland, and I can see my other colleagues also in their bubbles. Also Susanna and Sharon I know are in New Zealand. And I'm sure this is where they spent much of their time in their bubbles as well. So we're going to have presentations from four people. The fourth person is Laura Baird, not here today, but she's provided us a video of some comments and contributions that she wants to make to the discussion. I know they're going to talk about the research they've been involved in, all of them. So I'm going to hand over to them. I'll just say quickly about who we've got. Of course, we've got Nick Long, who's Associate Professor of Anthropology at the LSE. We've got Susanna Tinker, who's Associate Professor of Anthropology at the School of Social Science in the University of Auckland. And Sharon Graham-Davis, who is Associate Professor of Indonesian Studies and Director of the Monash Herb Feith Indonesia Engagement Centre. And they're going to explain to us about the research they did and about some of the key findings, and that'll give us some opportunities for questions that follow. So at this point, I'll explain a little bit more about the questioning. There's a Q&A, you'll see at the bottom there's a Q&A option. People can post questions. But I suggest that you probably leave questions to the end. We'll go through the whole presentation, and then we'll take questions, and people can put up their questions on the Q&A, and we'll direct them towards the panel at that point. The presentation will take about 45 minutes in total, and then we'll have maybe 15 to 30 minutes questioning, depending on the amount of interest. I've already got some questions I'd like to ask colleagues, so I'm hoping others will also come well prepared. So I'll pass across to Nick to start us off, and I'll talk back to you again in about 45 minutes. Nick, thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan, and hello to everyone who's joining us. Thanks for tuning in. As Alan says, I'm an anthropologist at the LSE, and what I'd like to do now is take you back in time to the 23rd of March, when our Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, instructed everyone in the UK that we were to stay at home, with only very few exceptions, and with immediate effect. Now, for several weeks after that instruction, coronavirus case numbers and sadly fatalities continued to climb. But as they gradually began to stabilise as we approached the so-called peak, debate really began over how these very draconian lockdown restrictions might eventually be eased. There was talk of reopening schools. A lot of people thought that was a priority. There was talk of reopening retail in order to kickstart the economy. But there was also a very strong appetite amongst the public to have a greater degree of social contact than had been possible when we were literally just kind of battened down in our own homes. And so eventually, on the 11th of May, the UK government published what was called its Plan to Rebuild. And that plan signalled an interest in, although not a commitment to, allowing multi-household bubbles of the kind that New Zealand had at level three, and which New Zealand would also allowed single adult households and a few others at level four. And they very explicitly flagged the New Zealand case as a precedent that might be emulated. So for several weeks, the media was alight with talk of possible New Zealand-style solutions to our lockdown dilemmas. But it turned out, as time went on, that importing the policy developed in New Zealand into the United Kingdom was not a straightforward affair. And so I'm really excited to be part of this webinar where we'll be exploring what it was that the UK was able to learn from New Zealand, what it did import, lessons that it could have learned but maybe didn't, and to explore what some of the limits of that kind of transnational policy transfer might have been. So to start us off, I'd like to introduce my colleague and also my boss, Professor Laura Baer, who's the head of the Anthropology Department at the LSE. But she's also a member of SPY-B, which is the Behavioural Science Division of the UK Government's Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, which has been the principal body providing independent scientific and academic advice to UK ministers and secretaries of state as they try to handle the coronavirus crisis. So for the past few months, Laura's really been at the coalface of translating academic research insights into policy advice. And while it's a great shame, and I know she sends her apologies that she can't join us live today, she has recorded some thoughts on that experience to share with you all to start us off. So I believe Suzanne is now going to hand us over to Laura.
Thank you for this opportunity to reflect on the influence that New Zealand's social bubbling policy has had on UK government measures to ease social restrictions. I'm an anthropologist of the economy with a particular interest in questions of the public good. I am interested in how bureaucrats and politicians define the public good, how they think they can act towards the public good. And I'm also interested in citizens, and in particular disadvantaged citizens, including migrants' own definitions of the public good, and how these different definitions interact in social life. And my work in the past has led me to argue that the best way of achieving the public good in society is to use what I call a social calculus. And a social calculus is a way of measuring the impact of policy that focuses on its effects on the quality of social relations, the quality of relationships that we have with each other, and also, of course, it's their impact on inequality. And I've developed that kind of approach in the context of India, in particular in relation to public debt regimes along the River Hooghly that dramatically changed both the environment and the livelihoods of people living and working along that river. And more recently, I've looked at those themes in the context of the Thames in the UK. And so when the coronavirus pandemic hit the UK, I felt that I had something to contribute on the questions of how to respond to it, because I've been thinking through these questions of the public good and the centrality of equalizing social relations. And I think what the coronavirus pandemic has done, wherever it has impacted, is it has really centrally raised the questions of how should we now care for each other? How should our governments care for us? And it's really raised starkly as well these questions of inequality and disadvantage in relation to government measures. So this led to my role as a participant on SPY-B. SPY-B is a committee that sits under the SAGE committee, and its role is really to advise SAGE on behavioural influences on responses to public health measures. But our debates on that committee reflect a much broader range of issues. In my role, I've always centrally brought these questions of inequality and disadvantage and the public good to those conversations. So maybe next I could say a little bit about how the UK became interested in New Zealand's bubbling policy. In order to think about this, we have to look back at an earlier moment in the pandemic as it unfolded in the UK. The interest in New Zealand's policies came around the 19th of April in the UK, when we had still 5,300 cases a day. The levels of cases were rising. We hadn't reached our peak yet. And we'd already had, tragically, over 19,000 deaths. And it was in this context that the government and SAGE and Spivey started to think about recovery and renewal from the effects of the pandemic in the UK and also from the effects of the lockdown. We began to ask questions about how could we get out of this period of social restrictions? What sorts of society, UK society, should we open up first? And in that context, we turned to the New Zealand example because it provided a really interesting exemplar of how to open up society. What intrigued us was the ways in which the New Zealand government had really prioritized the rebuilding of social connections almost before anything else. So we thought this was a really important and crucial example. And we were also aware of the intense social suffering within UK society. YouGov polls showed us at that time that anxiety levels were extremely high. People were intensely worried, not just about members of their family who they were isolated from in their households, but also friends too as well. And we knew that the breaking of connections that had come with social lockdown had had deep effects on people's psychological well-being. And in this context, we turn to the New Zealand example. The modelers were asked to model what impact would occur if you had different sorts of social connections built between households at that point in the pandemic. And Spivey was tasked with looking at the behavioural issues around social bubbling. When I came to lead the writing of the policy paper on social bubbles for Spivey, crucially at the center of the ways that I began to think about the policy was the question of which sorts of households would this policy should this policy most benefit? Which members of society and which sorts of family structures would most need the extension of social bubbling? And really, the simple answer to that question came when I looked at ONS and other figures and the anthropology and sociology of social support in the UK, was that the households that would most benefit would be the most disadvantaged households in UK society. It's clear from ethnography and sociology of disadvantaged groups that they rely centrally on for the provision of care and social support on broader networks than just an isolated nuclear household. And it was clear that we had large numbers of these disadvantaged households in the UK, which had different sorts of structural features. There were families, for example, who were disconnected from elderly relatives who they could no longer support. There were also lone parent households, there are 14.9% of those in the UK, who were not able to connect up with other households to share childcare. There would also be isolated individuals of various kinds who were not able to connect up to their networks of friendship and support. There would also be multi-occupancy, usually low-income households that also would not be able to connect with the people that supported them either through resources or emotional support. Multi-occupancy households are very often sort of disaggregated groups of people who don't really have any real connection with each other, and therefore they would really benefit from being able to reach out beyond the boundaries, the physical boundaries of an actual flat share or house share. It was also clear that particular community groups would benefit from a social bubbling policy because they think of the household already within their kinship ideas as being extended beyond the immediate household as taking in a much wider group of people. So that would include kinship ideas amongst Hindu communities, Muslim communities and Sikh communities, and also amongst post-industrial working class communities. All of these groups of households had been severed from these vital connections, which they used to share resources, information and care. And it was those households that I really spoke to and wrote about when I led the authoring of the Spivey policy.
Facebook, and a comment by one of my friends, Francesca, who's from New Zealand, got me thinking, because she was talking about how even during level four, people who lived alone could have buddies, so they didn't have to endure lockdown in complete isolation. And I was thinking, this would be very interesting to study and learn more about. There was nothing like that in the UK. Maybe it would be interesting to do a comparative case and see whether or not these buddies really do help, and whether or not there might be complications associated with buddies. Was the scheme as good as it sounded? So I reached out to Sharon, who I've known for many years because we both work on the anthropology of Indonesia, and asked her if she would be keen to collaborate on a little project investigating buddies, and happily she was. And then we built together a big collaborative network of scholars, including Susanna and many others, who are all interested in thinking about questions of care and support and responsibility and legality and many other issues in the context of lockdown measures and coronavirus pandemic response. So we began by investigating the buddy scheme through a survey device targeted primarily at people living in single person households, but with other households surveyed as a kind of background control group, as it were. But when Jacinda Ardern announced that for level three, all households would have the capacity to slightly expand their bubble in order to bring in caregivers or support isolated people or reconnect with family and whanau, we realised it would be really interesting and really important to get a sense of what exactly was happening in that moment, how people in New Zealand were responding, both because that was very interesting for its own sake to understand how a society was reconfiguring its networks of support and relationality within those kinds of public health policy parameters, but also because we realised that that could provide important empirical data of how a bubble scheme worked in practice that could inform policy debates in the UK, but also elsewhere. So we scaled up our existing survey and actually put together a whole series of qualitative surveys exploring how New Zealanders had lived during levels 4, 3, and 2. And we did various kind of advertising campaigns. We got over 3,500 responses to those surveys. We've also been conducting semi-structured interviews with people to hear more about their particular experiences of the lockdown. And I, together with some colleagues, have been running parallel research in the UK to see how people in Britain have been responding to shifts in our lockdown regulations. Now, I'll tell you a little bit more about that aspect of the research later. But first, I think it would be great to share some of the findings from our New Zealand research, input that we were able to give directly to UK government advisors and government departments to help them think through the pros and cons of bubbling. And so, Susanna, perhaps you could now tell us a little bit about what our research in New Zealand indicated regarding the benefits of bubbles, whether or not they lived up to the promise that Laura just outlined, and some of the limits that the bubble approach might have had.
So thanks very much, Alan. So I'm going to be focusing on the New Zealand survey results, and I'm going to start just by giving you a really brief overview of what we collected in these surveys and then dive into some of the analysis and our interpretation of them. So as Nick mentioned, we did a series of three surveys. The first survey took place during level four, and it had 1,770 responses. The second took place during level three and had 1,338 responses. A final survey during level 2 had 536 responses. The self-selected sample showed a heavy skew towards female, Pākehā, or New Zealand European, and highly educated respondents. That said, given the sheer numbers, it did garner voices of members of various ethnic groups, genders, and sexualities from around the nation. Across the respondents, there were often very strong expressions of goodwill towards the lockdown. Now, this could, of course, be in part because these are the very kinds of people who might feel compelled or attracted to fill in a survey about the lockdown. Nonetheless, it was striking how some of their descriptions mirrored the language of the government. They spoke of being part of a team of 5 million. of being a part of something good and doing our bit. They reminded us that we should be kind to everyone and remember we're all in this together. When they spoke about their actual experiences of their bubbles, their impressions varied. Some reported feeling generally very positive, while others had overall negative experiences. The question we asked ourselves was, are there common social dynamics that may have underpinned these? Our analysis found that people who describe themselves as flourishing during the lockdown, and I use that word purposefully as it really captures what they tried to communicate, they were the ones who were able to strip things back, and they really relished that. We have a huge cross-section of voices, people from all walks of life, describing how good it felt to slow down and simplify their lives, spend time with their partner and children, and focus on their household. On the other hand, those who found themselves struggling were often the ones who were unable to either determine the nature and shape of their bubble or to influence its members' behaviors in terms of how they conformed or not to lockdown regulations. As we've noted, the power of the social bubble is that it enabled people to think outside of households and to consider things like having a work bubble for essential workers, for example, or allowing children in joint custody arrangements to move between households. But when people felt like they had no control over this flexibility, it caused them stress. Some essential workers, for example, felt deeply sidelined due to their own or others' fears that they might contaminate them. Even if legally they were allowed to be part of someone's bubble, they might not be wanted. Then there were those with complex childcare arrangements. For example, families that span multiple households. When their kids are going back and forth to a former partner's household, in which his girlfriend includes her own children, who are also moving between households, and who knows where they are going or what they are exposed to, respondents felt that decision-making about how large and permeable a bubble might be was never actually in their hands. Another category where problems were often raised were those who cohabited but were not interconnected, such as flatmates who were neither kin nor friends. This was another scenario where some said they felt excluded from decision-making around the bubble, whether in terms of how strictly to uphold the rules or who might get let in when bubbles expanded slightly at level 3. It was, of course, different when groups worked together. For example, one man who flatted with two other housemates spoke about how during the move to level 3, each of them opened up their bubble to their romantic partners. While he was aware that this contravened the legal regulations, he felt strongly that it was all right, as it upheld the spirit of the law. This phrase, the spirit of the law, became incredibly important in our analysis. Repeatedly, people spoke of supporting the lockdown regulations, but then doing something that contravened them. Often they recounted quite heartfelt stories of feeling compelled to break the regulations despite their desire not to. Usually it was to undertake quite mundane but extremely meaningful forms of outreach, going for a walk with a relative who was in mental distress, or sharing a beer with a friend at opposite ends of the driveway after the death of a family member. What made such situations fraught was the fact that people were often wrestling with obligations that pulled them in multiple directions. They had their responsibilities to the people in their bubble, to their kin, who may or may not be members of their bubble, to their jobs in some cases, and to their idea of community, nation, or state, i.e. doing the right thing by the broader collective, however they conceptualized it. One way that we've been thinking about this is through the idea of competing responsibilities. This is a concept that I've been working on for several years, initially in conjunction with Catherine Trundle at Victoria University, as a way of elucidating how even in advanced liberal societies that emphasize individualism, we necessarily engage in interrelations that require responsibility towards others, be they family members, friends, workmates, students, or the broader community, nation, or state. Sometimes these bonds of obligation can pull us in multiple directions. We see this during the lockdown, when someone desperately wants to do their bit for the nation, but is also compelled to check up on those who are struggling, and thus may end up breaking down or breaking lockdown regulations. Competing responsibilities is quite useful for describing the sort of situational dynamics people often found themselves in. But how do people actually go about reasoning their way through them? This is more of a tricky question, as the survey data isn't perhaps as rich as it could be on this point. But one way that I've begun to think about this is in terms of the ethics of proximity. The ethics of proximity is not just about social distancing, but also about keeping close. Anthropologists, sociologists, and philosophers, from Marilyn Strathern and Zygmunt Bauman to Emmanuel Levinas, have noted how all human relations are based on ideas and practices related to proximity. Part of the work of interrelations is endeavoring to keep near to you those who it is thought should be near, and maintaining distance from those who are intended to be afar. And of course, this happens in different ways, in different situations, and can change over time. For some people, lockdown threw this on its head, as you had people who were suddenly always close, who didn't necessarily intend or want to be close. And you had those who were distanced, and yet felt like they shouldn't be. What was interesting was the ways that people attempted to balance out these relationships. This, I think, begins to answer, at least in part, the question of why, when your daughter, mother, sister, friend, or lover, who are out of your bubble, were suffering, you didn't just jump onto Zoom or onto your mobile to talk to them, but you may have felt the need to actually physically bring them back into the fold, so to speak, to extend the bubble, even if just briefly, to create a common space with them, a space of co-presence, a space in which you palpably changed the sense of the proximity of your relations to restore them as you felt they should be. So that's just a short overview of some of what we found with respect to bubble making and bubble breaking in New Zealand, and some of the ways we could go about interpreting it. We're now going to turn back to Laura Baer and to the situation in the UK, specifically to ask, if the UK government had at their disposal information about the bubble system and how it was operating here in New Zealand, with all of its strengths and weaknesses, why in May of this year did they not impose bubbles in the UK? And we now turn to Laura Bird answering this question.
We can now turn to the very interesting question of why, if these social support networks and social networks of care are so central to the well-being of communities and families and individuals, why were they not immediately introduced within the UK once we authored our paper? Well, it's really interesting to reflect on this question now. And I think that the reason that this bubbling policy was not introduced was really because there were three constituencies within government who were really pushing back against it. The modellers had the view that it was too early in the stage, in the movement towards the peak of the first wave, for these policies to be introduced. They saw the social networks within households as being a really problematic vector of transmission and infection. And so when they modelled this, they found that the R rate would increase too much if you allowed anything more than lone individuals or a lone individual in a household to join up. But another kind of pushback came from the behavioural scientists. They argued that, in fact, the bubbling policy would be too complex for people to connect to and introduce. They even argued that it might lead to senses of social ostracism amongst people who were not included in the bubbles, who were not chosen to be part of household bubbles. It was considered also too complex to negotiate in terms of a household thinking about who should we connect to and why should we connect to them? Should we connect to our children's friends? Should we connect to an elderly person that needs help within our neighbourhood, who actually should we connect to? And the behavioral scientists really thought that all of us would have problems negotiating the rules. As anthropologists, I think Nick and I have a different perspective on this, and we know that people negotiate these sorts of social relationships the whole time. And we're also aware that the lockdown itself had completely disrupted the normal practices of social relationships, and people were already reflecting on them in a very intense way. So I don't actually agree with this kind of pushback against the introduction of social bubbles that had occurred really amongst the broader behavioural science group within government in the UK. There was another group of people who were also pushing back against these measures, and these were civil servants within government who felt that there was a general trajectory and a push, a too great a desire to open up too fast. And so they really pushed back against us arguing for a fast introduction of bubbles, because they felt that the momentum within government was too great towards that already. So now, thinking back on that policy, it's very interesting to see, to reflect on that moment from now, from the perspective of when some elements of the bubbling policy have been introduced by the government. I think that if I had been in charge at the time, I probably would have started the easing of social restrictions with gradual forms of social bubbling. And the reason that I would really have pushed for that is because I know that without these social relationships, without our connections with each other, there's no possibility of recovery and renewal in the wake of the impact of lockdowns. And I think that really the way that our governments could most act in our public good, you know, both in that moment that I lived through and in the current moment and looking forward as potential second waves arrive, is to really act for the public good by prioritising the creation and recreation of social networks through social bubbling policies, and taking that as the last thing to drop when you go into a situation of lockdown or social restriction, and the first thing to take up as you come out of it. And for me, issues around the economy can wait, and that this is the only foundation on which you can recover and renew. So thank you very much for giving me the chance to reflect on the making of this policy. And I just wanted to say that the example of New Zealand was really a kind of shining light in this process. And it's clear that your government did prioritise recovery and renewal through the rebuilding of social relationships. So thank you.
Kia ora tate. My name is Sharon Graham Davies, and I'm an anthropologist and Indonesianist just starting at Monash University in Melbourne. I want to talk now about challenges associated with bubble formation and maintenance during levels 3 and 4 here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. The takeaway from my bit is that while there were challenges around formation and compliance, people in New Zealand were by and large committed to forming and staying in their bubble. And deviations were mostly motivated by notions of care for the self and care for others. As we heard in Laura's talk, the last thing to drop and the first thing to pick up must be social connections, and that it is social connections that lead to recovery and renewal. Our research showed that the lockdown relaxation measures that would lead to the biggest improvements in quality of life, even above takeaway food, were social visits between households. So how did people form their bubbles at level 4, especially given the lack of time to prepare? For many, bubble preparation was easy. Bubbles naturally mapped onto their household, and their household provided its own exclusive economic and social security. Indeed, there was an implicit expectation and assumption that one's bubble would be a self-sustaining household. Many respondents mentioned that bubble formation was simple. A mum of 3 said, "Forming our bubble was easy, we just stayed put." But there was some bubble trouble at level 4. While for many the bubble did map onto their household, this was not necessarily unproblematic. In a number of instances, people faced significant challenges, such as those where people were in share house arrangements, or those with shared custody and childcare arrangements, or essential workers who worried about bringing COVID-19 into their household, particularly if it included vulnerable people. In many cases, there was sadness about who had to be left out of their bubble, as many people were ineligible for a bubble buddy or did not meet the prerequisites to expand their bubble in level 4. A woman in her 40s revealed that her elderly parents had complex health needs, and her father, who was the primary carer for his wife, had a stroke weeks before lockdown, and they needed more support than they received. People sought to overcome bubble challenges as New Zealand moved to level 3. One way was through expanding their bubble, often by merging two discrete bubbles. Bubble expansion was keenly desired, and almost half of level 3 respondents expanded their bubble. Expansion was easy for some, hard for others. A nurse of South Asian background found people didn't want to share her bubble because, as an essential worker, her job meant she risked carrying the virus. Laura mentioned that two of the primary reasons for reluctance to adopt the bubble system in the UK stemmed from, one, potential problems negotiating social relationships and the complexity of connection, and two, that there would be high levels of bubble non-compliance, which would result in increased infections. We heard of examples of both through our research. In terms of the complexity of connection, one woman noted that her partner's father wanted to join their bubble, but she refused to allow him because she felt he wouldn't disclose how many other family members he was visiting. In terms of bubble non-compliance, over the 33 days of level 4, police issued almost 6,000 infringement notices, and these would have included bubble non-compliance. By and large, though, respondents found both the negotiation of their bubble structure and the compliance of directives manageable. One man noted that in terms of bubble formation, we had a bubble meeting and set some rules around living in the bubble. One person would do the shopping, there would be no contact outside the bubble, everyone should let everyone know if anything changed. In our research, we also found that where negotiation and compliance were difficult, people focused on the spirit of the law to enact acts of care and support. Need, not want, was the primary reason for bubble violations. As one woman put it, "We would love to add my parents to our bubble, but it would be for social reasons. So unless I really felt like I needed them, we won't extend." The bubble system faced challenges, and these were especially evident amongst people who shared housing out of economic necessity, people who shared childcare or were sole carers, and for essential workers for whom fear of contagion meant some care needs went unmet. Tensions also arose and were exacerbated where people in various existing relationships realised differences in ideas of sticking to bubble rules. But the bubble system did work in providing many people with a way of maintaining valuable social connection. The concerns raised in the UK around the complexity of negotiating who would be in your bubble and that bubbling non-compliance would have negative impacts are valid, but these were not borne out in our empirical research. Kia ora and thank you.
You certainly are. Kia ora, everybody. So although, as Sharon says, our evidence from New Zealand suggested that the concerns that UK behavioural scientists had about non-compliance and about tensions between people over bubble membership were perhaps overstated, bubbles were eventually, or at least these expanded bubbles, were not introduced in the UK in May, despite great anticipation on the part of the public and in the media. Instead, outdoor gatherings of up to six people at a time from as many different households as you liked were allowed. And that could be in a public park or it could be in a garden if you had one. Now, this kind of arrangement did actually have some advantages because it allowed people to negotiate their complex webs of relationality. It gave opportunities to fulfill those multiple obligations and those competing responsibilities that Susanna was talking about earlier. You didn't have to just choose one household to be your bubble buddy or your bubble, your co-bubble at the expense of all others. And many of the respondents in the UK saw it as much safer because they thought, well, outside, you're not going to be at risk of getting coronavirus in the way that you would be inside. What was quite interesting was that when we did our survey at level two and we asked people in New Zealand, would you have preferred outdoor gatherings compared to indoor bubbles? Actually, in New Zealand, the indoor bubble was seen as safer precisely because of its exclusivity. People were saying, well, if you met up outdoors with six people, you wouldn't know who they'd met with the day before. You could be exposed to the virus very, very easily. So it was interesting to see how different understandings of risk and danger and contagion were associated with the policy measures that each nation had introduced, leading each group of respondents to feel that really it was their policy that had been the safer one. So there were some advantages to these outdoor gatherings in the UK context. But I think what it really revealed for me when I was thinking about it anthropologically is how, although it allows some kinds of obligations and responsibilities, some kinds of care and support duties to be discharged, the fact that the gathering has to be outside at a 2 meter distance makes it difficult to fulfill others. And so the very analytics of care and support needed qualification to think about exactly what arrangement of bodies in space was necessary for care and support to be discharged. So if you think, for example, about somebody who's been recently widowed, recently bereaved, now living alone, it might be that if a minister wants to come and provide some kind of consolation, and it's very important to do that in person so you can get a sense of body language and like read the atmosphere and see how the person's being affected. You could do that outdoors at a 2 meter distance with other family members present. You could provide that kind of emotional support. But if you wanted to make sure that that widow wasn't waking up alone, that she knew there was someone else in the house, that there was someone to help with the cooking and the cleaning and just all that kind of practical stuff that you've got to deal with after a bereavement, outdoor gatherings in a garden's not going to cut it. You need the indoor contact that is permitted by the bubble. And it was precisely that kind of care that wasn't possible in the UK in May, let alone things like physical contact with sexual partners, hugs with grandchildren, things that people were desperate to have. So although the outdoor gatherings were seen as reasonable, there was generally quite a lot of disappointment. And in terms of the question of enforceability, what a lot of our UK respondents said was that actually the outdoor gathering was harder to enforce because how could you stay at a 2 meter distance? It was so tempting to just give someone a reassuring touch or a hug. You didn't know how safe that was. A lot of people who had kids said they didn't dare have the outdoor gathering because they weren't confident that the child would stay at a 2 meter distance from the people they were meeting. And if the child broke that guideline, then that could lead to a lot of tension in the relationship. So it raised, in my view, as many problems as it solved. Now, as a coda to all of this, on the 10th of June, against the backdrop of a major U-turn in the UK government's policy on reopening schools, suddenly, out of nowhere, a policy was announced that for households in England and also in Northern Ireland, so-called support bubbles would now be available for people living in single adult households. So that was anyone living alone or any solo parents with children under the age of 18. So a very similar arrangement to the lockdown buddies that had been possible in New Zealand's level four. This meant that you could now pair up with a household of any size if you were that single adult household and get some company and get some support. Scotland and Wales held back on doing that, but as of July have now allowed any two households to merge, regardless of size, in what they're not calling a bubble, but instead calling an extended household. So we're finally seeing some of the kinds of social support and social renewal that Laura was talking about, but it's been very fractured across the four nations of the UK. In England right now, we can now receive indoor visits from one household at a time, but those visitors have got to remain 2 metres apart when they're indoors. So it's still not possible to get some of the very particular kinds of care and support that might require physical touch. Now, when I look back on everything that's been going on and is continuing to go on around these bubble policies at the minute, it's hard to escape the view that the actual care and support needs of the British public have been relegated behind political point scoring between the leaders of Scotland, Wales, England and Northern Ireland as they, in different ways, gamble on whether it's more prudent or more politically advantageous to act optimistically in ways that involve a fast opening up, or to be more cautious in leading their populations out of lockdown. And of course, in the context of bids for Scottish independence in particular, how one frames oneself as a responsible leader, opposed to the measures that are being introduced in England by the national UK government, has got quite a lot of political bite. But as an anthropologist reflecting on all of this, what I think really haunts me, what's coming through very strongly in the research that I've been doing in the UK, and what I'd like to close by making reference to, is the enduring testimonies of those people, particularly in England, where a New Zealand-style bubble merging is still not possible, not fully, those people whose specific care needs are still going unmet. And these are the specific care needs that require physical contact. So that might be people in relationships who are not living alone, but they're living with others who are still not able to be together. It might be people with childcare needs, where that child still can't be held or played with. There was a lady who filled in our survey who spoke of how she was the sole carer for a husband with catatonic schizophrenia. So he wasn't able to speak, he wasn't able to offer her any practical or emotional support, and yet because they were a two-adult household, they didn't qualify for a support bubble. It wasn't clear whether or not support for him constituted a medical need. She felt it probably didn't, and so she didn't feel that she could take advantage of support being offered by her adult children, who she was desperate to see. So what the lockdowns possibly taught us is that neither indoor bubbles nor these outdoor garden gatherings, which were posed as a dichotomous choice in the title of this seminar, neither is really a perfect solution. Whichever you adopt, there's going to be someone that loses out. And there might be certain groups that always lose out, like the essential workers that Sharon was talking about, who have repeatedly shown themselves to be shunned and ostracized at all versions of these policies because people see them as having an unacceptable degree of infection risk. And what this really highlights to me is how blunt our current pandemic preparedness had been. Even in New Zealand, where I think a lot of things were done much better than has been the case in the UK, there was still very much a one-size-fits-all policy that led some people to fall through the cracks. And what I hope is that on the basis of the experiences that people have had during this lockdown and some of the research that we and others have been able to do during the lockdown, in future it might be possible to start thinking about tailoring measures so that the way that we address any kind of lockdown or wide-scale social distancing regime can be much more bespoke, particular to the needs of specific groups who all move through and experience the pandemic in specific ways and with specific needs. And I think it's maybe a call for that kind of more differentiated, more particularistic and more compassionate pandemic preparedness that I would like to highlight as the key conclusion that we can learn and that we might need to implement very soon if vaccines are difficult to obtain and coronavirus comes back with a vengeance at any point in the near future. And I think on that, I will close and hand back to Alan.
Thank you very much, Nick. Thank you. Thank you to all the presenters there. I was excellent, really thorough and very smooth. And I do want to kind of just make a special thanks to Suzanne Woodward, who's working behind the scenes for us, behind the arts webinars, making this so smooth in its kind of presentation. So thank you, Suzanne. Hang in there. I know you're going out for dinner, I think, afterwards. So not be too long now. So we've got a little bit of time, and there's an opportunity for questions. As I say, if people would like to use the Q&A option, we can bring it all up. We can all see it, I think. And maybe we'll try and take questions as they emerge. So people want to start thinking, they can just tap in and put some questions in. Maybe while people are thinking of that, I do have a question. I'm quite interested, because one of the things I think that's been really interesting in the UK, in New Zealand context, and we just had a report released by government about the use of media consultants in terms of supporting the kind of strategy that government put out and put together. Over $16 million spent on media consultants to put the package together to sell us the bubble model and how we would kind of operate it. I was wondering if that came up in any of the research. Sharon, Susanna, did that sort of become an issue that people recognised that there was a very strong message coming, a very consistent message, and that was something that helped them stay kind of focused?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure that people sort of reflected on the costs of it in particular, but I think certainly we saw the message coming through, and a number of people said how much they really appreciated how clear the regulations were, which was then rather funny because other people were saying, well, the regulations kept changing and I wasn't sure what this meant and da da da. But several people were saying, you know, it was the bubbles. Well, they might have specific questions about what's allowable at a certain level, but the idea of the bubbles, at least for most people where English was their first language, they felt like the bubbles were very accessible as a concept. Where we found that it sometimes fell apart was people who didn't have English as a first language and who were trying to either translate the term bubble or they just really couldn't kind of conceptualize what is this thing, this entity that is a bubble. But among English speakers, it seemed that most people seem to have a pretty good grasp of it.
Yeah, if I could just pick up on that, I'd say in the UK context, I mean, there was also a lot of money and effort put into a media campaign, but because of the huge numbers of cases and fatalities and the panic that the health service would get overwhelmed, the emphasis in that media campaign was stay at home or people will die. And there hadn't been very much thinking through of a message for what the reopening was going to be. So what that then led to was a lot of media speculation as to what this bubble policy, when it eventually emerged, might be. And people said, well, in Belgium, they're allowing you a list of 10 friends and family that you can associate with. And in New Zealand, they're apparently doing this, and in Canada they're apparently doing this. And then the social bubbles that have been anticipated weren't introduced, and instead we had these garden gatherings, and some people started referring to them as social bubbles. Oh, I'm getting together in my bubble of six today and then a different bubble of six tomorrow. And so the concept of the bubble, which it, the idea of it being an exclusive network, is really important to getting your head around it and it having force. That got diluted by the fact there was so much speculation and anticipation, which is partly to do with not having thought the issue through in advance. It's partly to do with the media campaign. A lot of it, I think, is to do with the UK government's strategy of briefing journalists in advance and using these off-the-record briefings as a main route of kind of disseminating information ahead of official announcements, rather than, I mean, they were having daily press briefings, but often that what was going to be said in them was being rumoured many days in advance. And I mean, I think that was it's clearly a suboptimal way to deal with this kind of emergency governance, because if you're going to have problems with compliance, the number one problem that we found that led to people not complying was not a disinclination to follow the rules, but rather a lack of clarity around what the rules actually were.
So we're not getting any questions.
So I can just pick up on that point. I mean, it's interesting. I don't think we heard anything about the cost of, you know, the advertising or the conveyance of information. But we are hearing a lot about the cost of quarantine. And Australia, as I found out today when Qantas called to say they've postponed our flight yet again, is that because we haven't landed today, we will have to pay $3,000 each for quarantine. So quarantining is getting a lot of backlash from the public. But I don't think we heard anything about the public messaging and what that would cost. I don't think that was covered.
I mean, I think what's really interesting about the public messaging is, I mean, firstly, the government clearly made a strategy very early on that the importance of messaging. And I always kind of think, you know, one of the things about Jacinda Ardern is that she, you know, she was part of the Tony Blair government machine many years back, who were very good media kind of people and understood the importance of messaging. And the second thing was the people they brought in, and they spent, you know, $16 million on it. It was the same report recently. There were top world leading kind of advertising agencies. And, you know, I don't know about you, I mean, having lived through that kind of period, found that messaging really powerful and consistent. And, you know, and they're very, very effective, I think. And so there's a debate about cost effectiveness around that kind of use of media, but it clearly, I think, was effective in lots of different ways.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I remember the night that in our weekly meetings, Nick showed the image from the UK that said, stay home or you will die. And we hadn't had any kind of messaging like that in New Zealand. It was really about, you know, support each other, be kind, be caring, you know, look out for each other. And it still strikes me when I remember that image. It was on a bus stand, and I just thought, what must it be like to be walking along the street and see that kind of public messaging as opposed to what we were getting here in Aotearoa?
Yeah, because that really it stokes fear, and fear leads to compliance, but it also leads to punitive, desperate punishing others who are perceived as lockdown transgressors, even though they might be acting within the rules because they have reasons to go out that are perfectly legitimate. And I think the emphasis on support that was coming through in the New Zealand messaging definitely did help people negotiate some of these problems of deciding who to bubble with, because you were thinking, it's like, well, who needs it? Does anyone need it? Maybe no one I know needs it, in which case I can just stay on, so we can stay to ourselves for a little bit longer. And I was very glad that when the UK government did introduce these support bubbles, that message about the importance of framing it as support rather than just socialising came through. But it's a shame that emphasis on social renewal and social support was not woven through the whole lockdown rhetoric in the UK. But as I say, that was partly a response to the fact that there were such sheer high numbers, there was such terror of health services being overwhelmed in the way that we'd seen in Italy, that maybe support wasn't the priority. And maybe at the time that was a legitimate call, it's just it ended up becoming counterproductive.
I mean, still no more questions. I'm going to keep asking them because I've got some other questions I'd like to ask. I mean, the other thing I kind of wondered was, of course, you know, New Zealand is 5 million, as Susanna said, you know, a team of 5 million, the UK is 60 million, right? So, you know, the idea of being able to bring one idea across to a country of such size and diversity, and you talked about, the borders as well between, you know, Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland and the likes. And I'm wondering if that, you know, was also one of the kind of challenges to the policy. And I guess the other bit to that was, we put bubbles in from almost day one, right? It started off right at the very beginning, whereas what I kind of think from what you're saying is in the UK, the notion of bubbles was tried to be introduced later into the kind of time frame. That then was kind of problematic. And I wonder if those two kind of factors, you know, the size of New Zealand compared to the UK and the timing, you know, were influential in effectiveness in a way.
I would say so. I mean, I think particularly the issue of timing, because if you've already got this idea that you're in a bubble, then the idea of expanding it kind of follows intuitively from that. But if you're now having to reimagine yourself as staying at home and then you need to expand the bubble, that's a bit harder to get your head around. But I think it could be done. I mean, I think if you had the Prime Minister giving a national broadcast, you had very clear infographics, the idea was clearly explained, it could be done, and it could be done across 60 million. I mean, 5 million is still a lot of people. When the epidemiologists did their modelling, actually what they found was you could have a thing where up to about 50% of people of households in the UK could expand their bubble by merging with another household, and it would still be safe. It would still keep the R number below one. But the problem was there were certain households, retail workers, essential workers, people who were basically going back to work, whose networks were leaky. And so maybe what was required was a more bespoke policy for these different groups, or a strategy that held back on reopening retail and reopening schools or reopening certain sectors, and instead prioritised the kind of social renewal that could come from merging households, because all of this modelling is done against background risks. And there are many more background risks in the UK compared to New Zealand, because they hadn't gone for such a dramatic lockdown. A lot of factories and so forth were still operating. A lot of shops were still operating that weren't operating in the New Zealand case. So I feel those issues that actually lead to social contact and a potential for contagion are more important factors that differentiate the context than just the sheer size of the population. I mean, the size presents a challenge in terms of communication, but I think it's a challenge that could be met and was met in terms of the initial lockdown quite successfully.
And it's interesting, a lot of those things you said about sort of people's different positionality, that's something that we saw respondents in New Zealand reflecting on themselves, particularly with the essential services workers. So people would say, yes, we know that this is allowable, but I'm an essential services worker, therefore I'm not going to see anybody, or I'm not going to have this contact, or I'm not going to engage with, you know, various sorts of forms of relationships, particularly when we moved to level 3. And there were other categories of people, so elderly, but also people who, you know, were worried about elderly relatives. So people were making those kinds of assessments of either being at risk themselves or being a risk to others, and making their own judgments about what was going to be allowable.
Okay, we're not getting any question and answers. No questions are being put up. Hoping there's no technical kind of problem. So is there anything that could be a technical problem, or is it just that you don't have any questions?
I think that people maybe have just covered everything.
Okay. I've got another question, but I won't go on. I mean, I think we should probably finish there, guys. It's getting into 8 o'clock in the evening here in New Zealand, and I know it's getting 9 o'clock now in the morning, Nick, for yourself. Hang on, we've got a Q&A. We've got a question come through. We're listening, Peter. Thank you. Okay. Well, we're going to finish at that point. I do appreciate at least the acknowledgement the system was working, Peter. So I'd like to thank all the speakers, Nick, Susanna, Sharon, and of course Laura, who's not here, for video contribution, for really fascinating discussion there around bubbles and the relationship between those and policymaking in the UK and in New Zealand. So I'll leave you to your day, Nick. Have a really nice day. Enjoy. And to Susanna and Sharon, good evening, and be well. And to everybody else, I'll kind of leave it at that and say good night. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Kia ora. Mā te wā.